So some of you are doing projects related to planar graphs. Raise your hand if you're doing a planar graph-like project. I mean, I'm sure some of you maybe haven't realized yet you have a project. Mostly related to planar graphs. You guys are doing planar graphs. Maxwell's promoted correspondence is only planar graphs. Unless you want to do it for higher genus graphs.
I was talking to this morning, but there was an open house in industrial open house, so I stuck there.
What kind of open house?
Industrial open house.
Oh, that was today. How was it? Yeah. Good?
It was really good. But then I stuck there, so I forgot to talk to you. So.
All right. I was sitting there wondering where you were. You should have emailed me. All right. So, all these algorithms that have planar graphs, if you started to wrestle with them a little bit, if you started working on these projects, you'll find that it's not so easy to figure out how to draw a planar graph. Now, if you play the planarity game, you really see that if someone gives you just the vertices and edges of a planar graph, it's really not clear how to draw it. And the fact that Kruth's algorithm says, here, just write out one linear system, solve the linear system, that is to say, invert this one matrix, and it will tell you exactly how to draw the graph. That's pretty wonderful, I think. Let's just do a quick recap. How does the algorithm work? You start with a graph. So you have your graph, and then you produce L, which is the Laplacian, the graph Laplacian. So it's the matrix here. And this matrix L, we decompose it in a way so that, well, this is an n by n matrix, and this is an n vertex graph. Let me put that in here. N vertex graph, n by n matrix. And so the rows and columns is a symmetric matrix. The rows and or columns, however you like to view it, of the Laplacian matrix correspond to vertices. So when I pick out some vertices in a particular face, then I'm picking out some rows and columns of the Laplacian. Turns out that if I just permute the rows and columns, keeping it symmetric, that's just like looking at the image of this graph under some isomorphism, right? Relabeling vertices is just graph isomorphism. It doesn't change. The Laplacian matrix will change, but the mean doesn't change. It still encodes the same graph. And what we do is we permute it so that we get this top part corresponding to the outer face, which we'll talk about a little bit more, and then you get the rest of it, and let's call this, I think I called this some matrix B and B transpose. So if there are H vertices on the outer face, right, L1 here is, this is H by H, B is n minus h by h, and L2 is n minus h by n minus h. Now, we saw that you take the Laplacian, and you take an embedding of the vertices, which we don't have yet, but if you had one, and you took the Laplacian, and you multiplied it by the coordinates of the vertices, this is an n by 2 matrix, which for each row is the x and y coordinates of a point, but this is equal to the residual force on each vertex. This is this itself is a matrix that's, again, n by 2. And every row in F is a vector. It's a two-dimensional vector. It's the direction that is being pulled by its neighbors, assuming that every edge is a spring with spring constant negative 1. So they're all pulling on each other. And there's some residual force. And you just get it by multiplying the Laplacian times the position, get the force. All right. And now to do the actual embedding, we use this decomposed version, and we see that since we can choose where one face goes, we choose where those first H vertices go, we put them, say, in convex position, we get the following. We get that L1, E transpose, L2, B, times, let's call this P1, P2. This is not a fraction, this is me just breaking the matrix up into two pieces, where P1 is the positions of the outer face, We choose these, we know these. P2 is what we actually want to find out. And what we get is the residual force on the outside, and the residual force on the inside we want to be zero. We want everybody to be in static equilibrium. All of the forces, for every vertex on the inside, all the forces should add up to zero. And this linear system encodes that exactly. So from this, we get what you would actually code up would be the invert L2, because doing this matrix multiplication blockwise, or at least extracting the subsystem, you get that B P1 plus L2 P2 equals zero. And from that, you get exactly what you want, which is, it tells you what P2 is. It's just negative L2 inverse B P1. And that's just a little bit of algebra. Now, we had to be able to invert L2 to do this. And so I showed you how Tut had argued, using this power tool, the matrix tree theorem, that L2 really must be invertible because it's counting the number of it's counting the number of spanning trees of some graph, in some connected graph. And so there's at least one spanning tree, so its determinant is positive. If the determinant is positive, then the matrix is invertible, so we can do this. So you can actually solve this linear system. You use your favorite method, say Gaussian elimination. Invert that matrix, multiply it by B, and then the coordinates of the outer face here. And that will tell you exactly where to put B2. Does that look right? That looks right. When you multiply a bunch of matrices together, if you want to do a sanity check, what do? You just look at the dimensions, right? N by N by, N minus H by N minus H here, times an N minus H by H. Is that right? Yes. And H by 2. Should give us an n minus h by 2 matrix, which is the two coordinates for each of the n minus h points in the interior. Okay? Any questions about this recap? So if you missed last class, now you understand everything.
And here, the determinant of L2 is not equal to 0.
Right. L2, the determinant of L2 is actually equal to the number of spanning trees of the graph you get by taking G and taking its outer face and sort of collapsing it to one vertex by just contracting edges. So it's a minor, there's a minor of G, which is you contract that outer face to one vertex, you remove that row and column. L2 is actually the Laplacian of that graph minus one row and one column. The matrix tree theorem says the determinant of such a matrix is the number of spanning trees in such a graph. And since that graph is connected, this is there's at least one spanning tree. So the determinant is positive.
What number of spanning trees?
Oh yeah, so why is the matrix tree theorem true? There's a couple relatively nice proofs, none that I'm going to try to do now, or we'll be able to page it entirely, but it comes mostly, the easiest way to think of it is to decompose the definition of a determinant, the little Laplacian, and just check. You literally just check that you get, in the sum, the terms are either 1 or 0, and they're one if and only if it corresponds to a spanning tree. And so when you add them all up, every time there's a spanning tree, you get one, and the count comes out to be the number of spanning trees. It's a wonderful theorem. It goes way back to the beginning part of the 20th century. It's not the only way to show L2 is invertible. The other way I mentioned is just you can check that the it's a symmetric matrix in which the diagonal entries are larger than the sums of the absolute values of the off-diagonal terms in each row. And any such matrix is positive definite, and therefore invertible. Okay. All of this depended on us first finding a face, and interestingly enough, this is the problem that always gets skipped. I know of three textbooks that cover this, and I don't think any of them say you actually give an algorithm for finding a face. But let me tell you a little bit about how you get a face of a planar graph without drawing it first. Remember, we define the faces to be the things you get after you draw it. So you draw the graph and just look, connected components are the faces. But we did hint from Whitney's theorem that the faces were already determined before we drew it. We can draw it in different ways so the faces look different, but the vertices along any of these cycles that form a face are going to be the same in any drawing, as long as the graph is three connected. So let me first just introduce a definition that will save me fumbling over the words simple, planar, and three connected again and again and again. We'll say that a graph is, I'm going to say, polytopal if it is simple, planar, and three connected. Now, this is a bit of a presumptuous definition, because until we actually prove Steinitz's theorem, perhaps next time or the time after, it's not clear that graphs which are simple, planar, and three-connected really correspond in some meaningful way to polytopes, but they do. We at least stated Steinitz's theorem, which said that these polytopal graphs really are the edges and vertices of some convex polytope in three dimensions. So polytopal graphs, and Tuck's algorithm really only applies to polytopal graphs. Is it worth seeing why these conditions are necessary? Obviously, if it's not planar, you don't really expect to find a planar drawing. Simple, again, if it's straight lines, you have more than one edge between two vertices. The straight lines are the same edge. They're going to intersect. But the three connected one is the fun one, and we saw this a little when we first introduced planar graphs, that when you have three connectivity, well, two connectivity was enough to have the faces be polygons. So they're at least simple cycles. This three connected condition is really is nice. If you don't have three connectivity, if you only have two connectivity, you can just I always want to say from your physical intuition, but I had a professor in graduate school who had this incredible intuition about Laplacians, in particular about the sort of spring systems. And he would always say, oh, you know, if you have a spring system, you just look at these modes of vibrations, and he would tell you about the eigenvectors of whatever graph you had, and no one else could understand. So I apologize if I keep saying your physical intuition, but in this case, I think you really can do this. So I'm going to try it. Let's pretend that we only have a two-connected graph like this. It's not three-connected because I can remove these two vertices and I have separate components. If all of these edges are springs, what's going to happen is these guys are going to get just pulled together. There's no... I fixed this as the outer face, and if these springs are pulled, all of these vertices are going to lie out of line. So there is some sense in which this three connectivity corresponds to having three affinely independent neighbors, which is going to keep things from getting degenerate and getting flattened out. Okay, that's roughly why we care about three connected. But as we'll see, this turns out to be not only necessary, but also sufficient to capture all of three-dimensional polytopal graphs.
Three connectivity, and if necessary for having one just unique drawing?
Combinatorially unique, yeah. Obviously, you can perturb the vertices, but but you don't get different faces. Faces are still vertex, this vertex, this vertex, this vertex. And we'll see why in a second. So once you have a polytopal graph, we can define a certain kind of cycle in that graph called a peripheral cycle. So a peripheral cycle in a graph G, cycle C in a graph G is an induced cycle. Say what these words mean. An induced cycle in G such that G minus C is connected. Okay, so if you have a graph and you take just some of the vertices of the graph, the induced subgraph is the graph with just those vertices and any edges that were in G that only use those vertices. So, give you an example. That example. Okay. If this is my graph, and I take, say, these four vertices, the induced subgraph is the graph with these four vertices and these five edges. I have to take any edge that uses only vertices in the subset. So another way to say an induced cycle is saying that I take the subset of vertices and the induced subgraph is a cycle. So in this case, this cycle right here is not an induced cycle. Because when I take the induced subgraph, I get this other edge here. So if this one was not here, or if it was split, say, like this, this would be an induced cycle. In this case, this is not a peripheral cycle, though, because if I removed this cycle, I would get two different connected components, one here and one here. So it's not a peripheral cycle, but it is an induced cycle. Okay, and G minus C here means this here is the induced subgraph removing the vertices of C. So it's the induced subgraph G after removing vertices of C. Is this vocabulary all new? This idea of an induced subgraph? Have you studied induced subgraphs before?
No.
You heard this before? No? Yeah. No? All right. Learning. It's important. This is not just geometry now. It's a fundamental idea in graph theory. All right. So peripheral cycles, why are they useful to us? Well, it turns out that these peripheral cycles for a polytopal graph are the faces. So in a polytopal graph G, a cycle C is a face if and only if it's peripheral. Okay, why is this true? Well, there's two directions here. It's an if and only if. So first, assume that C is peripheral. Let's show that it's a face. So first, assume C is peripheral. It's a polytopal graph. That means it's planar. You can draw it. There exists a drawing of G. So let's draw G. C will be drawn as a Jordan curve. right? Because it was a simple cycle in the graph. If you draw it, it's going to be a simple cycle in the plane. However, because removing C, let me draw the graph first. So you have some graph. You have some cycle C. Because this is removing the cycle C, wouldn't this be out?
Just a quick question about polytopia. Yeah. I thought it had to be simple so you can have curves.
Simple doesn't mean straight line. It just means there's no self loops, so there's no edge that has the same vertex as the two endpoints.
Okay.
And it doesn't have multiple edges, so it doesn't have like vertices U and V with many edges between them. There's at most one edge. You can pretend this is a straight line, it doesn't matter. In fact, given that we only proved the Jordan curve theorem for piecewise linear curves anyway, should pretend that I drew a piecewise linear drawing of this graph. But somewhere in here, there's the curve C, and since it's a Jordan curve, and since it doesn't separate the graph, all the other vertices have to be either all inside or all outside this curve. Because if not, if there were some vertices inside and some outside, there'd be no way, there's no path, there can be no path in the graph that gets you from inside to outside that doesn't go through C or vertex 16. So that means that we have all the vertices of G minus C. I should really write the vertices. Someone can tell me what the grammatically correct way to do this. The vertices of G minus C are either all inside or all outside of the drawing of C. So it's a base.
So why is there a problem if there's one inside and one outside?
If there's one, if there's a vertex inside and a vertex outside, then I claim any path in the graph has to include a vertex of C. Yeah. And a peripheral cycle is still connected if I remove the vertices of C. But if every path from, let's call this U and let's call this V, if every path from U to V requires a vertex in C, then the graph G minus C is not connected, and then this is not peripheral. Okay, so that's one direction. And so now once you have the cycle and there's nothing inside it, that's going to be just a face. Or if there's nothing outside it, it's the outer face. That's one direction. The other direction of the proof here is, if we assume C is a face, then fix any two vertices. Any two vertices of G minus C. We want to show that it's peripheral. Well, I guess first we need to check that if you have a face, it really ought to be, it really is an induced cycle. Let's just put that down first there. So I'll say faces are induced. And I'll just give you the picture. If I have a cycle here and I claim it's a face, the only way it would not be a face is if there was some edge called a chord, which would connect two non-adjacent vertices in the cycle. But if there's a chord here, that means the whole graph has to be inside. Otherwise, I could draw it outside, and the whole graph has to be outside. But either way, this graph now is only two connected, because I can remove these two vertices, and it will separate the graph. Because there's some vertices over here that are not connected to vertices over here. Okay, so faces at least are induced. Now we just have to check that G minus C is connected. How do we show that it's connected? Take any two vertices, and let's show that there's still a path. So let me draw you the picture. If it's three connected, since it's polytopal, it's three connected. So here's U, here's V. In three connected graphs, that means there's going to be three disjoint paths from U to V, somewhere in the drawing. Now, this cycle C is a face. So it has to live in, it can't have any edges which cross these paths. It can include some of these edges. Do all kinds of weird things, but the interior, this face has to be contained inside one of the three faces, or the three components carved out of the plane by the three disjoint paths from U to V. But if you look at those three pieces, each one of them is bounded by two of the three paths. And so no matter which component you put it in, there's always one path which doesn't get touched. So if I remove C, U and V are still connected. So removing one cycle doesn't disconnect the graph. So the cycles not only are induced, but they're peripheral. Any questions on that? I'll leave it with just the picture. Good. So this actually, this claim here implies Whitney's theorem. This is one way to prove Whitney's theorem. And maybe Whitney's another guy who did so much great work that if you Google Whitney's theorem, you'll get something else. But for now, Whitney's, we'll call it three connected graph theorem. He says that the all drawings of a polytopal graph are combinatorially equivalent. And I perhaps didn't define this notion of equivalence, but what it is, what it means is that if you take the drawing of the graph, one way to represent it is by its entire POSAC structure, or its half-edge data structure, or whatever data structure or data representation you like. Now, those data structures only capture the combinatorial information, assuming the data structure version, usually you also store the geometry, such as the locations of the points. But it's enough, if you just have the half edges, that gives you the combinatorial structure. And two such drawings are combinatorially equivalent if there's an isomorphism between their combinatorial structures. So there's an isomorphism between the corresponding cosets. Which is also in the case where you know that the vertices and edges are the same, it's just saying that the faces are the same, no matter how you draw them.
Why is it that the cycle cannot cross one of the paths?
Well, it's got to come back, right? Let's see. So if it's a face, so remember the interior of the cycle then is a connected component. So it's path connected on the interior. So when I draw the face, this is a, since the graph has a drawing, we assume we took the drawing, and let's, and so this is the drawing of C. This is the drawing of these paths, and that's how we got three components of the plane, carved out by these three paths. And now we said that C was a face, and so there's also a drawing of C in here. It's a face, so it's a path-connected component of the plane minus the drawing. So if the face crosses one of these edges, that edge will disconnect the interior of the face. The definition of the face was that it had to be a connected component of the plane minus the drawing. Let's draw one. Let's pretend that this was the face. The plane minus the drawing means I take all of R2 and I remove any point that I drew on. So that's like if the plane was a piece of wood and had a jigsaw and I just sawed along every line that I drew, how many pieces do I get? The pieces are the faces. If I have this cycle C, if it's a face, but it crosses some other path here, I'm going to get two pieces. This is not a face, but two faces.
Right, so you assume that is the drawing, so the line inside the circle, you're not touching the wall side.
Say it again, so the...
So if I have a graph and I have a cycle and I have another path in the middle of the cycle, I can draw it by taking that thing out, putting it outside, around the cycle. So you're assuming that the problem is something like that.
Yeah, so I can do that, right? Because there exists a drawing. We at least know that it's planar, so the definition of a planar graph, there exists a drawing. So draw it. And now, in that drawing, C is a face.
How about if the cycle touches just one vertex?
If it touches just one vertex of what?
Of one of the paths.
That's fine too. The point is that when I remove, so I didn't put write the conclusion here, but it should be that C touches. Or touches really intersects at most two of these paths. So U and V are connected in G minus C. And this is true for any pair.
The cycle touches all three of them, and there's no way to draw it without cutting the cycle.
Right. Yeah. And that's because each of these pairs of paths forms a Jordan curve. So you really will not be able to, I don't think you can't make a statement like this without appealing to a topological theorem like Jordan curve theorem. So, how do we find a face? Now that we know what the faces are these peripheral cycles. You should at least believe that there exists an algorithm that terminates, given a polytopal graph that terminates and outputs a face without having to draw it. Even if you don't believe yet that the algorithm works or that there is an algorithm to draw a graph, you can still find a face in the polytopal graph because you know you just need to find a cycle, induced cycle, where if I remove it, the graph is still connected. Nothing in this definition makes any appeal to the drawing. Any specific drawing. So this is a purely combinatorial characterization of the faces in a polytopal graph. And so you could check every cycle. That's a bad idea. So in looking for a better algorithm, I didn't find one. I realized I taught this before and I just sort of skipped over it. And at least in a little bit of Googling, I didn't find one. I figured it'd be easier to just make one myself. So let me give you a first idea of what I came up with, and we can refine it together if you have some ideas on what would be a better version.
What's the problem definition?
So the problem is, given a graph, a polytopal graph, find a peripheral cycle.
So given a graph, we can always find the half-life state structure for the graph?
I don't know. That's hard. First, you have to draw it. What do you think? Can you find that half-edge? You can. It might not be a half-edge data structure corresponding to a planar embedding of the graph. That should blow your mind just a little bit.
That is not correct, the half-edge data structure, because the graph is just combinatorial, and for every embedding we have different half-edges.
Yeah, so you could come up with some version of this. You can come up with a half-edge data structure where it sort of represents the graph, but maybe not the drawing of the graph. Maybe that's one you have to play with to see. Turns out that you can represent graphs on arbitrary kinds of surfaces just by ordering the edges that come out of each vertex. So if you know what order, at each vertex, if you know which order the edges should go, if I go as I walk around, say in clockwise order, if I know that information, which is, if you'll recall, is the information we got out of the incident structure, then you know pretty much everything. You could build a half-edge data structure. You could find the faces. You can actually find the faces just by doing a traversal. Okay, but you don't have that yet. In fact, that's sort of what we're trying to find. So how might you start if you're looking for a peripheral cycle? I'll wait for at least one idea. Where would you start if you're looking for a peripheral cycle in a graph? Who has a bad idea? Everyone's afraid to give an idea because they're afraid it'll be bad. How about someone give me a bad idea? Give me a mediocre idea.
Can we go to depth first search, and if we reach to a cycle, but it has some other cycles in it, discard it?
Okay, yeah, so first he said you run depth first search to find a cycle. Okay, good. That's a great, at least that's a great start, because there's at least a cycle. And we can, and now you say you sort of want to check if it has other cycles in it. But another way to phrase that is check if it, maybe it is peripheral, maybe we're done. Why am I trying? So let's just check. If it's peripheral. No, I don't know if this is the right algorithm yet, but let's just start analyzing. Yeah, this is linear time, not so bad, right? Linear time is the size of the graph. The graph is linear in the number of vertices, but it's planar. Check if it's peripheral. What do we have to do to check if it's peripheral?
We have to remove the cycle.
Yeah, see if it's still connected.
You have to see that all of the degree of the adjacent vertices, what is the degree, and by this we can see the cycle is peripheral or not.
Yeah, you need to check if it's induced first, right? You have to check that it only has two other neighbors in the same cycle. Mm-hmm. And then you have to just check if I remove it, is the graph connected? How do you check if the graph is connected? Maybe depth first search again? How do you think?
Can you check the vertices, see if there's any vertices that connect?
Should be
no. Maybe you have to have a vertice in there, there would have to be connected to three of them. I don't know. But I don't know if the inside versus outside, that would be tricky.
Does it matter?
I guess not.
If there's a, I mean, in the inside and outside doesn't happen until you actually draw it.
Yeah. If it was outside then.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
So, if it's peripheral, we're done. What if it's not?
You have to take a cycle inside of it. You just take a cycle inside of it.
Take a cycle inside of it.
If it's disconnected when you remove it, then there's a cycle inside of it you could take. There's a vertex inside of it.
Vertex.
A vertex inside of it. And then you can, and then you can take that and then keep going down until you find one that's peripheral.
Sounds pretty good. I'm going to make one little change to this first part, though. I'm just going to write BFS instead of DFS. You know why I might do that? Breadth first search, it's a depth first search.
So if you do a BFS, and if I look at that U, and you find out all the areas, it's going out of view. Now, if your face is if removal of that face leaves any two vertices disconnected, then I should be able to catch it from BFS because you know when you start from one vertex, you know who are all the universe of that particular vertex.
BFS, I think, usually gives the minimum cycle.
So it gives the minimum cycle from the starting point. So the minimum cycle I claim will be induced. So you get the, at least that's an induced cycle for free. Because if I give you the shortest cycle containing a vertex, so here's my particular vertex, there's not going to be any chords in here. Because that would make a smaller cycle. Okay, so if I do BFS, at least it guarantees that I'm going to find not just a cycle, but an induced cycle. And now, if it's not peripheral, I know that I have, when I remove it, I have at least two connected components. So what I get, what I'll do, is I'll try to, that cycle has broken the graph in pieces. I'm going to try to take a piece from either one side or the other. And now I'm going to try to repeat, but you have to be careful to get this right. And I came up with a couple different possibilities. Let's first draw the whole graph. So pretend, let me just draw you like a graph. You pretend there's all kinds of other vertices on here. Okay. So if I found some induced cycle, okay, then if I remove the cycle, I'll get some vertices on the inside, some on the outside. If I just took, say this as my new starting point, I can now repeat the breadth first search, but I can stop at the boundary. Because I know if I find two different shortest paths to the boundary, if I have two short paths to the boundary, that will give me a new induced cycle here. Because I know that if there's shortest paths, there's no chords in here, and that there's no chords in here. So that will give me a new, smaller induced cycle, and I can try to repeat there. Yeah.
Sorry, to check for connectivity, can't we use like Laplacian matrix to check the number of spanning trees there, if it's more than one?
It's overkill, though, because computing the full determinant is like,
okay.
Well, let's say it's n cubed time, whereas technical connectivity is linear time in a graph. You just sort of walk through the graph. You see, everything I could find, I'm connected to.
So that's a bad idea then, I thought.
Yeah. Well, the reason I hesitated is that technically solving linear systems on the planar Laplacians can be done in linear time as well. But that's pretty heavy. Not even all that well known. All right, so I believe something like this works. So I've included this in the lecture just to kind of hopefully convince you that there are simple algorithms, and it should be the case that when you break the graph into two pieces, one of them has less than n over 2 of the vertices, and so you should be able to solve. When you repeat, you're only looking at n over 2 vertices, and so this takes linear time, and this takes linear time, and then you recurse on a subproblem of size half this, then you're going to look at in total linear time. So you can find peripheral cycles, that is to say, you can find phases in linear time.
So this algorithm is the best one for finding peripheral cycles?
Almost definitely not. This is just what I thought of. Now.
Yeah.
It's the one that we just thought of.
I'm a little confused about the finding of time for the new cycle. It's not very long. How are we choosing if that's more or one?
Well, you know, you're going to do depth, you're going to pick any vertex outside here and do a breadth first search.
Yeah.
And if you find more than half the vertices, you know you're in a big component. If you find all the other vertices, you know it was connected and then it was a peripheral cycle. If you find only a small number, then you're good to go. You found a small subset, and now you're going to repeat.
So you take this, whatever the smaller part was, and you just take some cycle in there.
Right.
And then you know it's getting smaller each time.
I think you do have to be careful about how you do this to make sure that you keep getting smaller. But
yeah.
Good. So now we can get to the fun part. The really fun part is figuring out why the heck that's an algorithm that the solution to this linear system gives a non-crossing drawing.
So is it clear that in the smaller part we're going to find a cycle?
What's that?
Like after we remove that cycle,
yeah,
we choose the smaller part.
And then we're going to keep repeating until they get smaller and smaller cycles.
And is it sure that we're going to find cycles there after we remove them?
Yes, because if you're going to find a cycle, first of all. Oh, you mean, will I even find a cycle?
Yeah.
The answer is yes, because the graph is three connected. If you go out and you don't find, if you go from any vertex, you're going to, and you don't find at least three different points on that cycle in your search, then if you only find two, then you can disconnect the graph.
But will the smaller graph also be disconnected after we move?
In theory, you don't have to search outside of the cycle. So outside the cycle, you can just connect, add a dummy vertex and connect everybody to the dummy vertex, and that will be three connected. That you have to check. Okay, I hinted last time that there were going to be four bad things that we want to not happen. Just draw the table again. Okay, I'm going to write these down, and for now, and actually for some of you the rest of your lives, you'll have to accept that as long as these four bad things don't happen, we have a proper drawing. Uh, let me write them down. There is a longer proof of this, but I don't think it's so useful to see. I think when I draw these four cases, hopefully you believe that this gives us a convex representation of the graph. So the first one was no zigzags on a face. And that just means as I go around a face, I don't see a right turn followed by a left turn, or vice versa. Obviously, if I have this, the face is not convex. The other way I could have a face that's not convex is if it winds around. No face winding. So I can't have a face comes around like this. So this one makes, say, all right turns as it goes around, but it's not a convex face. So as long as you don't have these two conditions, as we saw with Gram scan, you will at least have convex faces. So these two give us convex faces. And now I'm taking these faces, and you can imagine again that they are puzzle pieces. But they're cut out of wood, and I want to put them together, and I want to claim that when I put them together, they do all fit together as a puzzle. So there's a couple things I need to be true. It should be that there's no overlaps at an edge. So if I have a particular edge, highlight it. The two faces that use that edge, I can't have them on the same side of this edge. This is no good. That when I put these puzzle pieces together, edge to edge, they have one face on each side of the edge. Okay, so that has to happen. And the other is that as I put them edge to edge around a vertex, that they really do line up and make a single circle around the vertex. But in particular, it means that there's no winding around the vertex. Let me see if I can draw this one. So this is a vertex, these are the neighbors of this vertex, and you'll notice that this is a triangle here, say. And it's adjacent to this other triangle. This is this triangle. And it's adjacent to this triangle. And as I glue these triangles together going around this vertex, I'm gluing them edge to edge, but they wind around twice. We want to show this a little bit. You might see that, in fact, these two notions are dual to each other. Right? There's winding of the edges around the face, and the winding of the neighbors around the vertex are just the same condition, but dual to each other. Of course, we have to check them separately, because we only drew the graph, and not necessarily. We haven't necessarily drawn the dual. Okay, so we have nice convex pieces, and then when I put them together, everything fits. The main tool we're going to use to show that this happens is we're going to find monotone paths in the drawing. I'm going to cut embedding. What does this mean? If I have a vertex in the drawing, vertex V, well, I know that it's in static equilibrium if it's an interior vertex. And so it's actually at the centroid of its neighbors. Remember, we saw that it was being in static equilibrium with all spring constants equal to -1 was equivalent to being at the centroid of the neighbors. You take the average of the x coordinates of the neighbors, the average of the y coordinates, and that's where you are. So a monotone path says if I take any interior vertex in any direction, so let's say this is a direction vector u, I can find a path from v out to the boundary, to the outer face, that's monotone in the u direction. So every one of these edges I take takes me further in the direction of u. So it's for all interior v, there exist monotone paths around, I should put another quantifier in here, for all directions u, there exist monotone paths. There exists, let's say, a monotone path from v to the outer face. U monotone path.
Why monotone? And you mean why monotone?
I mean it's monotone in whatever direction. I can pick any direction I like. Generically, I'll pick a direction and I can find a path in that direction. So
monotone with regard to the direction.
Direction u, yeah. So a u monotone path, it means that every edge I take always increases my dot product with u. So if I parameterize this path so that at time t, I'm at some gamma t here, let's say v equals gamma of 0, and it's moving along here, gamma 1, then I know that t less than t prime implies that gamma t transpose u minus v is less than gamma t prime transpose u. Because the dot product, right, is just giving us the projection onto this vector. So as I move along here, I could look at just where I project onto this path, onto this line. And it's always increasing. My projection is always moving. That's what it means to be monotone. Probably most familiar with it in terms of when the vector is the x-axis to the y-axis, x monotone or y monotone. But same definition applies for any. Okay, and the reason this is true is that if I had a vertex v and I have some direction u here, and if there's nowhere I can go, if there's no edge that would come out of v in the direction of u, that would imply that all of the neighbors of v are on this side of the line orthogonal to the vector u minus v. And if all of the neighbors of v are on this side of the line, then v is not at the centroid of its neighbors. So once we have these outer faces, these monotone paths, what we'll do is we'll assume one of these bad situations happens. Then we're going to draw some monotone paths which we know exist. And from those monotone paths, we're going to construct impossible configurations to derive contradictions. So what are these kinds of impossible configurations? Well, we're talking about planar graphs. So the standard impossible configurations in planar graphs come from Kuratowski's theorem, which says what? That any planar graph that a graph is planar if and only if it has no K5 or K33 minors. So let's just recall Kuratowski's theorem. Planar, let's say planar, if and only if G has no K5 or K33 minors. Alright, and K5, you know, K33, complete graph, complete bipartite graph on 3 and 3 vertices. These two graphs are not planar, in fact, they are the non-planar graphs par excellence. So, how do we find a bad configuration using Lanfranc paths? Let me just take this Kuratowski's theorem and give you a slightly nicer tool for our particular case than something I call double crossing of face. So, let's take a face of a planar graph, and let's take 4 vertices, if it's right, A, B, C, D. These are just 4 of the vertices, but it's important that they're oriented, say, in clockwise order. There might be other vertices in between them, I don't care. My claim is that there cannot exist disjoint paths from A to C and from D to B. Obviously, I can have a path from A to C. I'm going to draw it on the outside because I think we're better at thinking about faces as being bounded faces. So if having a path from A to C doesn't keep this graph from being planar. But if I have a path from A to C, then I can't also have a path from D to B. Now, this graph still could be planar with a path from D to B. It just can't be the case that this is still a face. Right? So if this is going to be a face, then I would have to make a path from D to B around the outside. And there's going to be a Jordan curve here from this path and the part of the face from A to C here, or I can even go around this way, where D, actually I should go this way, where this path has to go from the inside to the outside of this Jordan curve, so it can't be disjoint. So one of these paths will say it's crossing the face, and you can't cross the face twice in this way. So there does not exist disjoint paths A to C and B to B. So you can actually prove this one via the, again, some kind of Jordan curve argument, but another thing you can do is, remember there's the condition that A, B, C, and D are on a face. If this is actually on a face, then this face has at least 4 vertices. So if you look at what this graph really is with this path, with these paths, if you can track those paths to single edges, it's K4. There's an edge from A to B, now there's this one from A to C, and A to D, and symmetrically everywhere. But if it's K4, then it's tetrahedron when we draw it, and every face should be a triangle. So here I have a face with 4 vertices, that's a contradiction. So that's the sort of quick other way of seeing that. You can't double cross a face in a planar graph. And now I'm going to show you that if some of these bad things happen, we're going to double cross some faces.
Don't have the first condition when we speak the CDR on a face.
Yeah, in fact, it can't be, right?
Yeah.
That's the contradiction you derive. You say, I assume that I have these on a face. So if I have these such paths, then there's a minor, which is K4. But
so if it's a K4, then if we draw, say for example, ABCD,
yeah.
If I draw an edge between any two corner vertices, like AC, then it triangulates it divides the face into two triangles. So what is the argument here?
Well, it would be okay. It would be okay if that's the only one you had. If you had A, B, C, D, yeah, you can take one, but you can't have the other as well. Because now A, B, C, D is not a face anymore if I have to add such a path. And it's still going to be plane. So we assume that we have a face that has four vertices on it.
Right. Okay. Yes.
Here I'm kind of appealing to some ideas about minors of graphs, right, where you can contract edges. Because the statements are true, or they continue to be true if you contract these long paths to be single edges.
So you're going to say if it's K4 and you draw only one such card, mm-hmm. it's okay. We can still have ABCD as a face.
Yeah.
I mean, we can take the outer, but then if I put two, then it's not possible. Because
right.
Otherwise, we'll not be able to draw it on the plane.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So what we'll see is that, for instance, if we have a face zigzag, will be the first one. If that face has a zigzag, then we'll use monotone paths to double cross it. Let's do that first. So here's the zigzag. And let's say without loss of generality, the face is now on the bottom side here. If it has this zigzag, what will we do? We'll take this as A, B, C, D. We'll look at, if there's a zigzag, I can cut this with a line here, and I can take the monotone paths from B and D that go up this way. What's going to happen? I'm going to get this path that winds all the way up to the boundary here, all the way up to the boundary here, and I can connect them. And I'm going to do the same thing with A and C, finding monotone paths that go down. Independent of what happens down here with the crossing, I've just given you disjoint paths. Why are they disjoint? Because the path from A down to the boundary is monotone, which means it never crosses this dotted line. The path from C down to the boundary is monotone. It also never crosses this dotted line. So every edge on this bottom path is below this line, and the same is true here, where every edge on the path from B to D is above this line. So that means those paths are disjoint before we double cross the face. Before it wasn't really a face, and so this could not happen in our drawing. So the only things we had to put together were the monotone paths and this double crossing limit. All right, I drew this so big I'm not going to give myself enough room for the other cases. Mind if I erase this and just draw the next one right here? Okay, the other ones are going to be almost exactly the same. How am I doing this time? 4, oh, shoot, where am I at now? All right. If I have a face that winds, it has to cross itself. If there is a face that crosses itself, let's see. Then I'm going to do exactly the same thing. I'm going to take A, B, C, D. I look at the crossing, I can draw some dotted line here. And again, I'm going to find monotone paths going away from this line. And since they're both going away from the line in different directions, and they're already separated by the line, they stay disjoint. And so I get two disjoint paths. And again, this face now that crossed itself, it didn't matter where I drew these other edges, as long as they appeared in this order. This is a double cross face. So this, again, this one can't happen. None of this, none of this. If we have overlaps, maybe I'll just draw it right here. If I take any this as A, say B, C, and D. Okay, this is not a single face, but if I have a if I have two faces that are joined at an edge, and I just remove the edge between them, then still planar. This rule about not double crossing a planar graph only depended on the graph being planar. So there could be another graph which I could draw, and it will still be a planar graph. And if I now I can find disjoint paths which don't use this edge, which I'm going to remove, I get a disjoint path from here to here and here to here. And so removing that edge would make a face. It would be a face in a planar graph. That gets double crossed. And the winding one, I believe, is very similar in that if you have a bunch of faces around a vertex, you can remove that vertex and glue all the faces together, and then it reduces to this case. So that is, I can take the planar graph, which has this vertex and all of its neighbors, and I can give you a new planar graph which just removes that vertex and all the edges coming out of it, and now all those faces become, that were incident to that one vertex, become one big face. And it's one big face whose boundary is winding. And so that's a planar graph, and we have to just check that, in this case now you have to take, maybe I have to draw it on here, you have to take some extreme points in some direction, because you have to be careful to guarantee that the monotone paths you find wouldn't have used any of the edges you removed. Because we only know that the monotone paths are guaranteed in the Totten bearing, but since I removed some edges, maybe I don't know that those monotone, right after I removed those edges, I wouldn't have those monotone paths. But since I'm going, say, if I take the vertices that are extreme in this direction and extreme in this direction, none of these edges that I removed are on those monotone paths. That's the kind of a rough version. It's a little more detail in the notes. Any questions?